Butler agreed for obvious reasons," Bascombe cut across his train of thought, "that we have to keep this discreet, Inspector. Cast in the wrong light, the loss of the Voice of London could be devastating to our credibility, you understand?" Finch understood all right. No thought of the man who was dead, of the man who'd killed him, or of bringing the murderer to justice. Bloody media people. Let's just cover our asses and get out of this mess with our jobs and pay packets and status still intact. Looking good and smelling of roses, like the one here on the floor. Unfeeling bastard. Roses. This one obviously had some significance, though right now Finch had no idea what. He knelt down to look at it more closely. Not a familiar colour. But then flowers weren't his forte anyway. He'd need to find someone who could tell him more about it. "Perhaps a stroke?" Bascombe continued, merely thinking aloud now, as he realized that Finch wasn't going to give him any audience feedback. No, no, too horrific. A quiet, dignified death in his sleep. Not that there was anything dignified about being poisoned, Finch thought, glancing back at the green foam that had bubbled from Prothero's nose and mouth, at the empty eyes staring fixedly at the ceiling. No mirrors up there, Finch thought. But then Prothero obviously never thought he'd end up lying on his back, with poison eating into his nerves and brain, unable to see himself in the last few seconds before he was unable to see anything at all. With that green gunk coming out of his nostrils, he probably wouldn't have wanted to see himself anyway. Footsteps clicking on the marble floor attracted Finch's attention. He looked up to see Dominic enter the room, paused to glance around, a little bleary-eyed, in bewildered disbelief at the sybaritic luxury all around, then come over to join him. He, too, looked down at the body for a moment. Not a pretty sight. But young in the service as he was, he'd quickly become used to seeing a large variety of corpses, especially in days like these. "Got any eyes or ears on this one?" Finch asked him, rising once again to his feet. "Chemcos were cut," Dominic replied. "Same M.O. as before, but we've got an elevator log ID."
"Let me guess," Finch remarked wearily,
already knowing the answer as well as his assistant. "She's in deep, Inspector," Dominic confirmed. 8. Terror. The old terror, the one she tried to suppress, the one she hated to think about and mostly didn't dare, the one where she woke shortly before dawn, and heard. Was she back there now? Was the old terror repeating itself? Or was this a new one? Whatever it was, Evie woke to the sound of a violent struggle, as she'd done so long ago. And that wasn't the only terrifying part. The pre-dawn violence was bad enough, but it was always, she knew, the precursor to a chain of events that grew more terrible still. But surely that couldn't be happening here. Not again. Not here in V's underground home. Not unless... unless someone had discovered the location of the shadow gallery. "V?" she called quietly, hardly daring to shout in case it gave her position away. The noise continued. But then she realized there'd been nothing like the barking report of gunfire, only the clash of metal, the sound of stamping feet and shouting. Slightly reassured, but still nervous, Evie tumbled out of bed, hastily pulled on a robe, and then silently and cautiously made her way along the passage to the shadow gallery's poster-littered living area. Creeping into a gloomy corner of the hall, she looked, and felt her jaw drop in astonishment. For there was V, his cloak thrown back over his shoulders, wielding a rapier in one hand, leaping and stamping as if in a deadly duel, cutting, parrying, and lunging toward a hopelessly overmatched opponent, a stationary suit of armour. Had he gone completely mad? The previous day she'd thought him dangerous, but that sort of threat receded into nothingness compared with this completely uncontrolled behaviour. But then she realized that, actually, he wasn't entirely alone, or at least not entirely unaccompanied. On a television set behind him, an old black-and-white movie was playing, a swashbuckler that looked as if it went back to the 1930s, with a dashing hero also fencing for his life and more besides, for love. And V was mimicking all the hero's moves in perfect synchronization, and speaking his lines as well, words he quite obviously knew by heart. With a last flurry of clicking metallic blows, he finally vanquished the helpless suit of armor and sent its helmet crashing to the floor. Evie could only smile to herself at the complete and absolute commitment of his lunacy. As the echoes of the tumbled helmet eventually faded into silence, he realized he was being watched.
"Oh," said V quietly,
quickly adjusting his mask, though whether that was to make sure his identity or his embarrassment was covered, she couldn't tell.
"I'm sorry," he continued. "I hope I didn't wake you."
"No," she told him, though that wasn't quite the truth. "I just thought you were fighting. I mean, fighting for real."
Whether there was concern in her words for him, for herself, or for the both of them, was something neither of them could quite decide. Leaving the question hanging, V turned and gestured toward the TV set, using the rapier to do so. "It's my favorite film, The Count of Monte Cristo, with Robert Donat as Edmond Dantès. It gets me every time."
"I've never seen it."
After all, it must have been made at least 50 years before Evie was even born, and now that there were far fewer TV channels than when she was a little girl, it wasn't surprising she hadn't come across it.
"Really?" asked V.
Then, with a rather charming eagerness, "Would you like to?"
"Does it have a happy ending?"
she asked tentatively, feeling somehow that, after all she'd been through in the last few days, happy endings were now the most important things in the world. "The Count finally finds peace in the arms of the beautiful Mercedes," he assured her.
"A happy ending?"
she asked again, still not quite certain what finding peace might imply. "As only celluloid can deliver."
"Okay," she said, smiling with just a little relief.
Then, looking at what he still held in his hand and remembering how carried away he'd been a few moments before, she added,
"But put the sword away."
Finch had returned to his desk at New Scotland Yard and begun to drain a steady succession of coffee cups. He ought to be used to losing sleep after all these years on the force, but on balance the older he got, the harder it got to take. And in spite of the continuing law and order clampdown by Creedy and his goons, the sort of crime that ordinary coppers had to deal with didn't seem to be going down at all. The more you took away the things that were important in people's lives, he guessed, such as liberty and freedom of movement, the more desperate they became. And desperate people didn't worry about what was right or wrong, only what they could get away with. He looked up then from the computer monitor where facts and figures were blurring into meaningless symbols before his aching eyes as Dominic came into the office flicking through a sheaf of printouts.
"Forensics just wrapped things up," the young detective told him. "No prints, no hair, no fibers. The guy's like a ghost. But you wouldn't believe the shit they found in Prothero."
"Drugs?"
"Could have started his own hospital."
"Interesting." Finch beckoned him over.
"Why?"
asked Dominic, coming round to join him behind the desk.
Finch indicated the monitor, where the meaningless symbols he'd been looking at a moment earlier now began to make a little more sense.
"Did you know that Lewis Prothero was one of the richest men in the country, before he became the Voice of London?"
"Drugs?"
Dominic's eyes lit up, as they always did when there was even the slightest hint of a hot lead.
"Legal ones," Finch said. "A major stockholder in Viadox Pharmaceutical."
"Wow!"
breathed Dominic, as the link snapped into place.
"Viadox and St. Mary's in less than a week. Coincidence?"
Finch shook his head, the faintest of smiles upon his face. His usual reaction to a hot lead.
"When you've been at this as long as I have, you've stopped believing in them."
In the black-and-white world of the TV screen, which had somehow had all the colour of magic to Evie for a couple of hours, the final romantic swell of music was coming up, with Edmond Dantès, the Count of Monte Cristo himself, nestled in the Tree of Happiness with Mercedes de Rosas. "Find your own tree," he addressed the final remark to the viewer, and as the end came up, Evie could only sniff. They certainly didn't make them like that any more, and she didn't care if that was a cliché.
"Did you like it?" asked V, looking round for the remote.
"Yeah."
To simply sit in safety on a comfortable couch and watch a movie after the last few days that she'd been having was a pleasure in itself.
but it made me feel sorry for Mercedes.
Why?
Because he cared more about revenge than he did about her.
V nodded, as if this was an acceptable female point of view, but not one that carried a great deal of weight with him, and clicked off the DVD player. BTN's regular news programming reappeared on the screen. And June, far more serious than usual, though it had to be admitted that in the last few days serious-faced newsreaders were becoming more and more the norm, was making yet another grave announcement.
"Fans nationwide have been devastated as news of the most popular..."
V started to reach out to turn off the set, but Evie put a hand on his arm.
"Wait, what's this? Most awarded stars in the history of the BTN," continued the familiar face and voice. "A man known to the entire nation as the Voice of London passed away late last night from apparent heart failure."
A black, bordered photo of Lewis Prothero appeared next on the screen.
"She's lying,"
Evie said flatly, her conviction absolute. "How do you know?" asked V, though obviously he knew well enough that she was.
"She always blinks a lot when she does a story that she knows is false,"
Evie told him softly, still trying to concentrate on the words of the announcement.
"An extraordinary talent, he had dedicated his life to his country and his beliefs, working tirelessly at his profession. It came as no surprise to those who knew him that his body was found at his office, where he often worked long hours after everyone else had gone home. Lewis, you will be sorely missed."
Evie could feel her hackles rising as V reached out to turn off the television. Something about all this just didn't seem right. So many things had happened in the last few days, and she couldn't quite put her finger on how they connected up. Except that, she began to suspect, they all linked back to V. And then she became aware that he was silently watching her, the mask's expression as unreadable as ever.
"V,"
she began hesitantly, hardly wanting to bring up the subject, as she didn't know where it would lead.
"Yesterday, I couldn't find my ID."
Still he sat there, regarding her in enigmatic silence.
"You didn't take it, did you?"
she asked nervously, dreading the answer as soon as she asked the question. She found she couldn't quite sit still, and the couch that had seemed so comfortable a few minutes before was starting to feel more like a bed of nails. "Would you prefer a lie or the truth?" he asked her in a neutral voice, suggestive of nothing but making the answer absolutely clear.
"Oh, my God!"
gasped Evie, jumping up from the couch and staring down at him in shocked disbelief.
"Did you have anything to do with that?"
A gesture toward the TV set made it quite plain what the "that" she was referring to was. "Yes," he told her calmly. "I killed him."
"You..."
Evie didn't believe she was hearing this, yet at the same time she knew she had to believe she was.
"Oh, God!"
"You're upset," V quite plainly stated the obvious. One of those facile pieces of phrasing that suggested he thought that acknowledging she was upset might somehow calm her down. Unfortunately, it had quite the opposite effect.
"I'm upset!"
she cried, trying to fight down a growing sense of near-hysterical panic.
"You just said you killed Lewis Prothero! Lewis Prothero!"
"I might have killed the fingermen that attacked you, too." He inclined his head in what she'd come to recognize as a gesture of inquiry. Usually uncomfortable inquiry. "But did I hear any objection then?"
"What?"
She almost choked on the word, suddenly taken aback. Why was he suddenly changing the subject? Or was he changing the subject? "Violence can be used for a higher purpose." Here it came again, that sense of being tutored in unpleasant truths. She took a couple of paces backward, suddenly nervous.
"What are you talking about?"
"Justice."
"Oh."
Evie paused as she thought of the movie they'd just watched, of the injustice done to Edmond Dantès, of the illegal imprisonment in the Château d'If, and although she had no liking for the principle of revenge, of the admittedly justified payback his enemies had finally received, and how, in the end, yes, she had thought there was a happy ending.
"I see,"
she breathed softly, understanding but still wishing to sound non-committal.
At times, V's view of the world was just too raw and uncompromising, too hard for her to take.
"There is no court in this country for men like Protheroe," V told her, though he didn't actually tell her what the crime had been that merited such final and fatal retribution.
"Are you going to—"
A pause, a deep breath, a question she didn't really want to ask.
"Kill more people?"
It hardly seemed necessary to answer, but he nodded anyway.
"Are you going to kill me?"
The question just slipped out.
"Of course not, Evie."
He rose to his feet and started toward her, almost as if he wanted to take her in his arms and reassure her. But then, of course, he would say that, whether he intended to or not.
"No, don't,"
she said, backing off a pace to match the one he'd taken toward her. Then, turning away in a gesture that effectively ended the conversation, she said,
"I think I should go back to my room now."
Finch, meanwhile, hadn't left his room at all, hadn't left his desk, hadn't left that same screen where he was dredging through the Nose's data retrieval system.
"Take a look at this," he said, summoning Dominic, who'd been doing much the same. "Protheroe's military record. What do you see?"
Dominic leaned forward, squinting at the screen.
Iraq, Kurdistan, Syria before and after, Sudan. Busy boy."
"Yeah." Finch swigged coffee. "But after all that, they put him in charge of a detention facility at Larkhill."
"No good deed goes unpunished," put in Dominic contemplatively.
"Right," agreed Finch, though he silently added to himself, "or bad deed unrewarded." Though he found it hard to think what the reward might have been in a place like Larkhill. Maybe Dominic was right. Maybe it was some misdemeanor that had got Protheroe sent there. But that wasn't what his instincts said. So maybe Larkhill had been more important than it first appeared.
"You think there's a connection between Larkhill and our boy?"
asked Dominic, after a few seconds' thought.
"It might explain the connection between him and the Hammond girl," Finch replied, though he recalled that the girl's parents had been sent to Belmarsh rather than Larkhill.
Still, detention camps were detention camps, and maybe it wasn't the camps that were the connection. It was Viadocs who'd come up with a cure for the St. Mary's virus, and Protheroe was a major shareholder in Viadocs, and in charge of Larkhill. And V had killed Protheroe. No, it all went round in circles, somehow, and didn't quite add up. But the name Larkhill was eating into his gut now, and he knew he was going to have to find out more. Such a pleasant-sounding name, redolent of birdsong and woodland and rolling English countryside. But then people probably used to think that Belsen was a nice place name, before they built a concentration camp there.
Larkhill. "Problem is," he added, "I can't find any other record of the place."
They looked at each other for a few seconds, but, as Finch had suspected all along, Dominic didn't surprise him with a brilliant idea. Instead, the expression on his face just said, "What do we do next?" Sometimes the boy was such a disappointment, thought Finch ruefully, smiling slightly to himself. But no, that wasn't really true. He had no more right to expect Dominic to suddenly solve things for him than he did the Almighty, and in the last 40 years the Almighty hadn't come through once. Yet. It was just that, unfortunately, Finch knew exactly what they had to do next, and he was absolutely sure it was going to be absolutely futile. But they had to go through the procedures anyway. Sighing, he got slowly to his feet and started toward the door, gesturing for the young man to follow. At least the journey he had in mind probably wouldn't take long enough to give Dominic time to kill them. A couple of hours later, Finch's frustration was starting to approach boiling point. He'd had quite enough of dead ends and stonewalling, as he'd also had enough of traipsing along what seemed to be endless miles of corridor on his redirected way from one filing clerk to another. And now here he was, sitting in an office at the Department of Military Records in the Ministry of Defence, the office of, he'd been told, the man who'd been there, the man in charge, who'd be just the blighter to sort out the problem for him. Fat fucking chance. Major Wilson had some of that same military pomposity that the unlamented Lewis Protheroe had had, though he still had the form and style to carry it off convincingly. An officer and a gentleman. Sitting there behind his desk with his back ramrod straight, and probably all the straighter in response to Finch's battered, weary slouch, he obviously had no time for civilian interference. Damnation! If this was what a career policeman looked like, he'd show him what it was like to go up against a career military man. Damned nosy bastard, anyway. And the boy with him looked as if he could do with 6 months' worth of square-bashing to knock him into shape. Young puppy had actually had the damn nerve to ask him a direct question a couple of minutes ago. Shouldn't be allowed.
"Larkhill?" Wilson queried, military bluster mingling with an apparent desire to help as Finch brought up the name yet again. "Larkhill? I don't recall that particular facility, Inspector. But of course you're welcome to review our records."
"We've been through your records, Major," Finch said through gritted teeth, struggling with no great success to maintain a dignified calm. "All they say is that there was a detention facility at Larkhill, approximately 10 miles north of Salisbury."
"Well then, there you have it," Wilson said smugly.
That'd show these civilian johnnies. Military records, absolutely reliable. At New Scotland Yard they probably couldn't tell the difference between a criminal record and a laundry list, if they could find either. Finch sighed and rubbed his forehead wearily, looking up at Wilson's completely false but oh so helpful, oh so condescending smile. And the bastard hadn't even offered them a cup of coffee.
"This is a matter of some urgency, Major Wilson," he said with exaggerated patience, determined that he wasn't going to fall into that old English routine where, if someone didn't seem to understand what you were saying, you simply repeated it louder and louder until he did. "We need to know if there was anything different about this facility."
"I'm sorry, Inspector," came the supercilious reply, "but I really cannot remember."
"Was there a specific profile for those being sent there?" Finch probed doggedly, exasperatedly.
"Usual undesirables, I should think."
"But do you know?"
"Of course not,"
snapped Wilson, his own patience starting to wear thin. A breath to regain his composure. Couldn't let these damned civilians get under his skin.
"I wasn't stationed there myself."
"Do you know who was?" Like a dog worrying a bone, Finch wouldn't let it go.
"I cannot recall any specific names," Wilson stonewalled again, "but if you look through our records..."
"Your records are either deleted, omitted, or missing," growled Finch, voice rising, patience finally exhausted. "As you were the head of the detention program at that time..."
"Before you go any further, Inspector,"
Wilson barked back, face starting to flush with anger,
"let me remind you that things were very chaotic back then."
Finch groaned inwardly, while Dominic looked on in helpless frustration. How many times had they heard that line already this morning?
"Right now we don't have the problems we had back then," Wilson continued flatly. "We all did what we had to do, and under the circumstances we did the best we could."
Then, finally, shortly, and in the act of rising to his feet, "And that's all I have to say about that." A couple of paces round the desk, a hand gesturing toward the door, a tight-lipped expression, and silence. That really was all that Wilson had to say. Wearily, frustratedly, Finch shrugged and got to his feet, accompanied by Dominic, saying nothing but giving Wilson a contemptuous glare that all too eloquently said, "Roast in hell, you pompous bastard," and left. An officer and a gentleman. Fuck off and die. 9.
"You can do this,"
Evie said to herself, taking a deep breath and looking down at the small piece of paper she had clutched in her hand. The same piece of paper with the address written on it that she'd taken from its place in the frame of her makeup mirror the night that all this had started. The night that had changed her life. Funny how you held on to things like that, even when everything else had descended into complete chaos. Well, if she was going to do it, it was time to make a start. Time to overcome that feeling of nervousness that she knew was only the surface symptom of an underlying dread she'd always felt, a fear of the world and all its parts. But sometimes that fear just had to be overcome, if only for a little while. Getting up off the bed, she left the room that had become hers, and returned along the passage to rejoin V. She found him sitting quietly, listening to soft music, masked and inscrutable as ever.
"Hello,"
she said tentatively, not even sure if he was actually awake behind that mask. And if he wasn't, was this the opportunity for one of those Phantom of the Opera moments? The unmasking, the hideous face, the horror? No. When she started to think of the possible consequences, it didn't seem like a good idea at all. And anyway, the nod of greeting he gave her showed he wasn't asleep at all.
"I've been thinking,"
she said hesitantly, sitting down on the couch and looking toward him like an actress not quite sure of her next line.
"I want to ask you something, but I don't think you'll understand why, unless you know a few things about me."
Another nod from V, and now he sat up straighter, quite obviously giving her his full attention. That at least was encouraging, but still she found herself picking nervously at a thread on the couch. What she wanted to tell him brought back unpleasant memories that she preferred not to think about. The past, her own past particularly, didn't make for idle conversation.
"My father was a writer," she continued after a deep breath.
After all, he'd been so dear to her, with his unruly hair and glasses, his gangling frame and lopsided smile, that since he'd been gone, it was always painful to even think of him, let alone talk about him.
"You would have liked him. He used to say that artists used lies to tell the truth, while politicians used them to cover the truth up."
"A man after my own heart," V remarked briefly, softly.
"He always told the best stories until—"
A pause. Another deep breath.
"Until my brother died. That was when everything changed. My brother was one of the pupils at St. Mary's."
And then the memories really did come back, with an overwhelming power, memories so poignant they almost made her weep now, just as she'd wept so much then, so many years ago. The intensive care unit at the hospital, where she hadn't really understood what was going on, but they'd all had to wear masks over their mouths and noses, and it wasn't the sort of mask you wore to play games in. And Mummy had been crying, and Daddy had been trying not to, as he held her in his arms and did what he could to comfort her. And Evie had been standing there trying to get her fingers under the mask to wipe away the tears that kept streaming down her cheeks as she looked through the plastic tent at little Timmy, whom she'd been angry at the day before for kicking his football at her, and who was lying there gasping for breath and covered with purple sores, and she'd never had the chance to say sorry for the nasty things she'd said to him about the football, and he'd never had the chance to forgive her for them, and she'd never forgiven herself for saying them in the first place, and she didn't understand it then, and she still didn't understand it now. But that was the last day she'd ever had with Timmy. They hadn't even been allowed to attend the cremation. And Timmy had been one of the lucky ones. One of the pupils they got out of the school alive, if only for a little while. As for the vast majority of the school kids who died on the spot and whose bodies had just melted together in a rotting, deliquescent mess before they could be identified, they'd just gone straight into a hole in the ground, pretty much there on the spot where they'd died. A throwback to the old plague pits in the days of the Black Death, only this time it was purple.
"After he died,"
Evie told V, pulling herself together as she moved on to memories less raw, yet only a little less painful,
"my parents became political."
A bit of fun, it had seemed to her at the start, standing in the street with her placard-bearing parents, wearing her school uniform and with her hair carefully braided into pigtails, handing out flyers to passing businessmen who usually promptly threw them away, and picking up the discarded leaflets and handing them out again. And again. The ones no one paid any attention to. The ones that were headed, "Viral weapons developed by U.S. military for use in the Middle East." That was another thing she hadn't quite understood at the time, but obviously it had meant a lot to her parents. Nobody stood out in the cold and rain and got shouted at, or worse, by passing crop-haired youths, unless they thought it was important. That wasn't fun at all. She hadn't understood the leaflets demanding "Stop the Government Lies," either. After all, Only bad people told lies. And why would anyone vote for bad people?
They protested against the war and the reclamation,
continued Evie, remembering how she'd been 10 years old at the time. That was when the Americans, after all their apparent successes in the Middle East, creating a desert and calling it peace, Daddy had said, quoting some ancient author she couldn't remember, had finally overreached themselves and were forced to pay the price. Fortunately, by then, successive British governments had got into such hot water with their own electorate for their unthinking support for American military adventures that they'd closed the U.S. bases here and sent the missiles home, pretty much as the rest of old Europe had some years before. And the NATO alliance being defunct was probably what saved the country when the Taiwan crisis came. Of course, no one had really expected what happened then, when it turned out that the American military hammer failed to smash China apart like the crockery their propaganda machine kept comparing it to. It was the hammer that broke on the porcelain instead, though not without immense loss of life on both sides. Then the hand that wielded the hammer had broken too, and the Second American Civil War had begun, and hadn't finished yet, though both sides seemed to have fought themselves into an exhausted stalemate now. It was one of those situations that cried out for international intervention. But before the war, the Americans had destroyed the United Nations, when it wouldn't just roll over and do what they wanted it to. England hadn't been immune to the chaos that had washed over the entire world like a tsunami after the war, with the collapse of international trade, the transnational banking system, and the food supply. With the oil crisis and the petty wars in South America, as the various states struggled for supremacy in the power vacuum left when the United States followed the United Nations into functional oblivion. And perhaps, worst of all, the changes to the global weather system. Evie could still remember how the Thames Barrier had burst and flooded most of London. More people had died then than from the St. Mary's virus. But that had been a natural disaster, so no one could make much political capital out of that, except for the religious right. But they saw the hand of God in everything, so everyone regarded them as a joke. And they were, compared to what was coming next. Because then the fascists had won the election, and started the reclamation. That hideous excuse for an orgy of ethnic, political, religious, and moral cleansing, in the name of reclaiming England for the English, and its appeal for Victorian values. The sort of values that had prevailed when the British Empire had still straddled half the globe, and maps of the world were printed mostly pink, that harked back to times when it was the white man's burden to bring enlightenment to the heathen savages. Only this time around the white man was disburdening himself of the heathen savages as rapidly and brutally as he could, and everyone who didn't believe in the one true God whose name was Jesus Christ, and who didn't have the right family values, and who was principled enough not to swallow the party line.
When Sattler was appointed High Chancellor, Evie went on, they were at the riot at Leeds. I watched it on the telly thinking I was going to see my parents killed. I remember them arguing at night. Mum wanted to leave the country. Dad refused. He said that if we ran away, they'd win. Win. Like it was a game.
And then there was the other memory, the second of the two that she always did her best not to think about, especially at night, especially just before dawn, the one that kept coming back anyway. The worst one, more awful yet than Timmy, the one she'd remembered that very morning when she'd confused it with the soundtrack of The Count of Monte Cristo. She'd been asleep, too, when that had started. Started with the sound of breaking glass, and the sound of a heavy iron ram battering in the front door. The heavy footsteps of metal-shod boots, the shouting, the gunshot. They should have expected it. It had been happening all across the country, and to people they knew as well. But when friends stopped getting in touch, it was far easier to delude yourself that there must be some minor reason for it, other than what you knew in your heart to be true. And always there was the feeling that these things only happened to other people, that it would never happen to us. But then nobody had really expected a fascist government would happen either. It was just after the gunshot, no more than a warning shot as it turned out, that her mother had burst into her bedroom, nightdress clad, and slammed the door behind her.
"Evie, quick!" she'd said with quiet desperation, hoping the intruders might not hear. "Hide! Under the bed!"
And she had. though not without her favourite Teddy, the one she'd always talked to in her troubles, the one who knew the magic word that took them off on dream adventures to a world where everything was lovely, now grabbed one-handed without thought. Then the door had been broken in, knocking her mother to the floor and revealing not the police they'd always half expected, but soldiers. Brutal, coarse, laughing among themselves as they ogled her mother in her nightdress, dragging her to her feet and pinning her arms behind her back, speedily fastening her wrists with plastic zip ties, and not caring where they put their hands as they did so. Evie, huddled desperately beneath the bed and overwhelmed with panic, found she could hardly breathe at all, only managing tiny mouse-like gasps. She looked up in absolute desperation to see her mother looking straight back at her, as if to fix her daughter's image in her mind forever, just before they pulled the shiny black bag down over her head. Then Evie had screamed helplessly, all control completely lost, and the flashlights had stabbed under the bed. And the soldiers had found her, and taken her away.
"I never saw them again," Evie told V, struggling with things she never talked about, and remembering then, with pathetic absurdity, that she'd never seen Teddy again either. "It was like those black bags erased them from the face of the earth."
Erased the magic word as well, and all the magic that had ever been in the world, and then there was nothing left but fear. Cold, dark fear that lived somewhere near the bottom of her spine, and, at the slightest opportunity, would suddenly rush up and engulf her entire brain and seep throughout her mind. "I'm sorry, Evie," V said gently, and with an obvious sympathy that transcended the usual platitudes.
"No, I'm the one that's sorry," she said,
trying to gather herself only to fall prey to another memory, of how, at times like these, so near to tears, her mother would always smile and tell her gently to
blow your nose and pull yourself together.
But ever since she'd said that for the last time, it seemed somehow that nose-blowing didn't help.
"I'm sorry that I'm not a stronger person. I'm sorry I'm not like my parents. I wish I was, but I'm not. I wish I wasn't afraid all the time, but I am."
She sucked in a deep breath then, steeling herself to say the words that all this had been leading up to.
"I know this world is screwed up. Believe me, I know it better than most, which is why I wanted to ask. If there's anything I can do to help make it right, please, let me know."
"If you wish," murmured V quietly. "If you wish." Another request, meanwhile, had been made at another ministry. This time one of the civilian, and infinitely more civil, ones. But still Finch and Dominic waited with growing impatience at the issue desk. How long did these things take? The rain had been coming down so hard when they'd arrived, in stair rods, as Finch's old mum had used to say, which was a stage quite beyond the usual raining cats and dogs, that they got soaked just walking into the building from their parked car. Now they'd been waiting so long, they were almost perfectly dry again. Mind you, it was Saturday morning, and though he and Dominic were prepared to put in the extra hours, they'd had to call out someone specially to help them here. And no doubt the man would be putting in for time and a half for Saturday work, so maybe it wasn't surprising that he was dragging it out for as long as he could. Or maybe it did just take this long.
"You really think we'll find something here?"
Dominic asked the elder man, as much to make conversation as anything else.
"Worth a shot," Finch told him,
wondering what it was these days that seemed to have deprived the nation's civil servants of coffee.
"One thing is true about all governments. Their best records are tax records."
At last, a door opened on the other side of the room, and the grey-haired, bifocaled filing clerk they'd first spoken to, a forgotten age ago, reappeared. Stooping slightly, he meandered across the office toward them, carrying a large box file. The expression on his face didn't look at all hopeful.
"It appears that the original electronic records have all been lost, probably during the reclamation," he said apologetically, seeing disappointment slide across the faces of the detectives like curtains closing on the casket at a crematorium. "A lot of things went missing back then, but I found this hard copy filed down in the vaults."
Still with a rather apologetic expression, he handed the box to Finch.
"Everything we've got on Lark Hill is in there."
And then he glanced up, almost in wonder, to see the look of grateful surprise dawning on Finch's lined and world-weary face.
"Thanks," Finch told him, for once meaning it quite sincerely. "This is a big help."
"Christ," he thought, "if only things always turned up like this."
Somewhat later, Evie made a discovery of her own. Passing the time until there was something for her to do, and trying to make her bedroom look a little more like home, she found some fabric to hang over the small amount of bare brick wall that was visible between the book piles, and had now turned her attention to cleaning the dressing-table mirror. As she scrubbed away the dust that V had allowed to accrue in what was, after all, a little more than a storeroom with a spare bed in it, she found a motto carved in Latin on the frame. Peering at it through the gloom that nothing seemed able to dispel, so dark the walls and ceiling were, so dark the books that gathered there before them, she finally managed to pick the words out enough to read them.
"Vi veri veniversum vivus vici," she said aloud to herself, though as she did so she noticed V appear in the mirror there beneath the words, and she could only gasp in amazement. For a moment her mind reeled. This was like the old days when she was a child, like the tales in the story-books her father had read to her, like the times with Teddy. For it seemed to her that she had spoken the magic words, and V had suddenly appeared genie-like in the magic mirror. And then she realized that he had really entered the room behind her, and his appearance at that exact moment was just one of those amazing coincidences. Yet such a strange one.
"By the power of truth, I, while living, have conquered the universe," he translated for her, moving forward into the room. She turned to face him.
"Personal motto?" she asked, knowing his penchant for all things related to the letter V.
"From Faust."
Of course, she thought. A magician. Who else would have the magic words?
"That's about cheating the devil, isn't it?"
she asked, after a pause to gather her thoughts.
"Cheating the devil, indeed." "It is."
A certain warmth in his voice expressed his pleasure at her knowledge.
"And speaking of the devil, I was wondering if your offer to help still stood."
"Of course,"
said Evie, her pulse quickening as she put down the cleaning cloth.
"It appears that unforeseen circumstances have accelerated my original plan. As a result, I am in need of someone with some theatrical skill."
"I'll do my best,"
she smiled, not a little pleased at his appreciation of her talents and the opportunity this presented.
"I believe you will," V told her, preparing to coach her in her script.
"Another doctor?" queried Finch,
not entirely sure whether he was asking himself, or Dominic, or the empty air, or maybe the rain, which was still battering against the windows. It never used to be like this, before the weather collapsed. Now it was weeks of drought, followed by a month's worth of rain in a single weekend. No wonder what water they had was so rigidly controlled. With it falling so heavily, all this would be running off down the sewers and into the Thames before anything useful could be done with it. If the sewers didn't back up again and flood the streets with sewage, as they had a couple of months ago. And that hadn't been the first time either.
"What does a detention facility need with so many doctors?"
Finch continued, picking up his coffee cup and, finding it empty, putting it down in disgust. They'd been here throughout the night, sorting through the tax files, sleeping occasionally in their office chairs, sending out for sandwiches when the canteen closed. And here it was on Sunday morning, and they didn't seem to be getting any further. The latest doctor was a Dana Stanton, one of a list that he couldn't quite remember the length of. The tax records they brought back from the ministry contained plenty of food for thought, even if a lot of it just didn't seem to fit together. Interesting. Suggestive. But puzzling.
"I don't know,"
Dominic replied to his question, going through a folder of his own. "But this is interesting. The highest-paid person in the camp was a priest."
"What?"
Puzzling wasn't the word anymore. That latest nugget of information seemed just completely incomprehensible.
"The Reverend Anthony James Lilliman,"
Dominic told him, seeming as baffled as his superior.
"He was paid almost 200 grand a month."
"That is interesting."
Finch typed the name Lilliman into his computer search engine.
Looks like he was promoted, he added when the information came up on the screen. He's a bishop now, officiating priest at Westminster Abbey.
Why on earth would a priest, whose official role at the camp appeared to be to ensure that rules and rights weren't violated, be paid that much? Unless it was some sort of hush money.
I guess we're going to confession tomorrow, then, smirked Dominic.
Yeah, Finch agreed, allowing himself a little smile of satisfaction, as it seemed they were finally starting to get somewhere on this case. And I'll bet his confession will be a lot more interesting than ours.
10. Early Sunday evening in the deanery at Westminster Abbey, now Bishop Lilliman's private living quarters, found two men, one young, the other considerably older, with rather different things on their minds.
"Your Grace?" the young man called, his voice somehow retaining a reverent hush while still carrying along the echoing corridor as he sought to catch up with the bishop.
A marvellous opportunity for a young priest, he thought this position as personal assistant to the bishop would be, until he'd realized just how personal some of his duties actually were. Still, needs must when the devil drives, even here in God's house at Westminster, and once he'd got used to the notion and some of the perks and side benefits involved, it still was a marvellous opportunity. Just not quite the way he'd thought it was going to be.
"Ah, Dennis,"
the bishop said softly, pausing and turning to look back as the young priest caught up.
"Has everything been arranged?"
"Yes, Your Grace," said Dennis hurriedly, eager to please as ever. "I've just received your interlink itinerary, and you should arrive in Perth in time to celebrate communion."
Lilliman smiled, but it was a smile much more suggestive of reptilian descent than pleasure, of tested patience rather than fatherly pride in his assistant's accomplishments. The sort of smile that went with his thin, lanky body, with the receding hairline and the almost shriveled skin-on-a-skull face. All he really needed was a forked tongue to complete the look. But Dennis had soon realized that the old hypocrite spoke with one anyway, regardless of what he physically had in his mouth.
"You are most diligent, Dennis," he began with a hint of sarcasm. "A noble example for all those who labour in the name of the Lord. But..."
"Your Grace?" queried Dennis, nervously, realizing from the bishop's tone of voice that the conversation was veering toward an area where, today anyway, he didn't really want it to go.
"It wasn't labour that I was speaking of," the bishop said, with barely concealed impatience.
Surely the boy should have come to understand him by now. And why was he looking so nervous?
"It was rather," Lilliman continued, "my final remittance that I was interested in. My last little joy."
"I'm sorry, Your Grace," said Dennis,
more quietly yet, unable quite to meet the bishop's eye and shuffling closer as if, alone as they were, he was still afraid they might be overheard.
"She's arrived, but there was some confusion at the agency, and they've sent a new girl."
An inquiring look from the bishop, and here at last was the crux. But it had to be said anyway.
"A new girl who, I'm afraid, is a little older than usual."
"Older?"
Lilliman asked, annoyance in his eyes, but still with marvellous control in his perfectly modulated preacher's voice.
"Oh, dear. Not too old, I trust?"
"That is for Your Grace to decide," said Dennis, dropping his gaze deferentially, hoping the explosion he half expected would never come.
"Ah, well," the bishop sighed, casting a glance heavenward. "If Job could bear his trials, I suppose I must bear mine."
And with that he turned away, opening the door to his bedroom, revealing something quite the opposite of a monk's penitential cell. Thick Persian rugs, antique and purloined from the storerooms of the Victoria and Albert Museum, were strewn across the parquet floor. The double bed was king-size, or bishop-size, as he preferred to think of it, and round the walls were not the images of religion, but icons of the grossest lust. Child pornography. Young girls painted in the roles of whores. Very young. The sort the agency usually supplied, and not just to the bishop, though not to anyone who wasn't somehow associated with the government or the party,
An exclusive agency, this. After all, it was run by the government. And there, a picture of innocence in the midst of decadence, blonde hair braided into pigtails, wearing a frilly pink party dress, quite plainly several sizes too small for her, but which she'd forced herself into anyway, and little white ankle socks, stood Evie, a nervous smile upon her face.
"Oh, my," breathed Lilliman, stepping closer.
"Your Grace,"
Evie curtsied, holding the hem of her dress pinched between her thumbs and fingers, and looking up, appalled but hardly daring to show it, into the lined and aged face of the dog-collared pervert into whose hands she'd fallen.
"To think that I doubted your loveliness for an instant,"
the bishop leered, running his eyes down her body from tip to toe and then back up again. Not the veal he usually dined upon, but a young and tender lamb nonetheless.
"Mea culpa, my child. Mea culpa."
Thank you,"
Evie said hesitantly, wondering whether this was such a good idea after all, wondering how long there was to go before V arrived. Not having to wonder, however, about whether the bishop was a quick worker, as he took her hand and led her over to the bed, sat her down and plumped down by her side.
"Why don't you let me help you with your dress, my child?"
he asked immediately, his tone of voice fatherly, his eyes burning with unsuppressed lust. He started to reach for her shoulders, stooping forward, his stick-like figure closing in like a praying mantis. But she shrank away, pushed his hands aside. For a moment he seemed taken aback. Surely the agency had explained precisely what was required. He paid them well enough, after all.
"Please, Your Grace,"
Evie said urgently, trying to fight down a sudden attack of nerves. Now was the time to do what she'd been planning, not to get involved in the bishop's disgusting little games.
"We don't have much time, and I have to tell you something."
"A confession?"
Lilliman laughed, annoyance disappearing. Perhaps the girl had initiative enough to make up for her surplus years, after all, and she was quite, quite delicious. Pretty in pink and perfectly succulent.
"I love the confessional game," he told her, licorishly, entering into the spirit of things. "Tell me your sins."
"This isn't a game, Your Grace,"
she told him desperately.
Why couldn't he understand? "Someone's coming, and I think he means to kill you."
There. She'd said it now. Taken the first step along what she hoped would be the path to redemption and escape. Hated herself for doing it, and knew it was a betrayal, felt exactly like the frightened coward she'd described herself as to V, knew that the description was absolute truth, and the only lie was that she wanted to do something about it. But if she could just keep her head out of a black bag.
"Pardon me," said the bishop in confusion.
People in his position just didn't get murdered. Who'd want to kill a man of God?
"I'm telling you this because I want some kind of protection or amnesty. I had nothing to do with the Old Bailey, and I made a terrible mistake at Jordan Tower, but I think this should balance it out."
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"My name is Evie Hammond," she said, trying to get the words out before he interrupted again.
So much to say, so little time to say it, and then it all spilled out.
I've been the prisoner of the terrorist named V for the past several days, and I'm telling you that at any moment he's going to come through that door, because I unlocked the window in the room where your man Dennis told me to get ready."
He stared at her then, the whites of his eyes starting to brighten with fear, and she thought, perhaps, the message was at last starting to sink in. He'd surely have heard of V with all that had happened since the Old Bailey, no matter how cloistered his life was here. Must have known about the Jordan Tower incident, too. The giant television in one corner of the room couldn't just be there to play the pornographic DVDs stacked up beside it, even if that was its main purpose. And if he was on V's target list, he might be high enough in the scheme of things to have heard about the actual cause of Lewis Prothero's death. But then he started to laugh. After all, weren't there two armed security guards outside the main door, provided by the government specially to deal with this current terrorist threat?
"Wonderful,"
he chuckled. The child certainly had an inventive talent for this sort of thing.
A game I've never played. What a delightful mind you have. I hope the rest of you is just as interesting.
A hand settled on her thigh, his aging skin like parchment, and began to slide up between her legs with a serpentine motion.
No, please,
Evie protested, bringing her knees together hurriedly. This was all going terribly wrong. Not at all the way she'd planned it.
You have to believe me.
Oh, I do. I do, the bishop told her wolfishly, forcing her back down on the bed. Let me show you the firmness of my beliefs.
Stop it,
she screeched.
Get off me.
But Lilliman was playing the game to the hilt by now, delighted even more as she began to struggle.
"Seems like I've captured the dangerous terrorist," he said enthusiastically, pressing down on top of her. "Now, how to best procure her confession?"
Rape was the obvious first answer. And perhaps later, if she seemed amenable, or even if she wasn't, a little carefully administered pain until she was begging for the forgiveness of her previous sins and the opportunity to commit whatever new ones he might have in mind. Yes. He hadn't had one who'd really responded to a good thrashing since that little brown-haired minx in the school uniform a couple of months ago. How could he have felt disappointed earlier? This was going to be absolutely sumptuous. Pushing and twisting, and with completely different ideas in mind, Evie finally managed to get one leg free beneath him, then brought her knee up between his thighs with all the force she could muster. Like cracking eggs. Lilliman screamed, automatically reaching for his crotch with both hands and rolling aside just enough for Evie to get in a right cross to the side of his head, sending him sprawling off the bed and tumbling to the floor. He lay there for a moment, gasping and wheezing, literally spitting blood, and figuratively spitting venom.
"You little bitch!"
he squealed, starting to crawl across the floor toward his nightstand.
"You filthy little whore!"
Sitting on the bed and massaging her aching knuckles, Evie watched and wondered. She wasn't quite sure why he was crawling away from her like this, but as long as it was away, that was all she wanted right at that moment. But he'd never listened to her now, and somehow the fear that she'd been trying so desperately to escape from had only dropped her into even deeper trouble. And then, with a shriek of breaking wood, the door was kicked in, and there was V, a demon in black, the cloak flapping behind him, the smile forever fixed. Sitting down on the floor, Lilliman's eyes grew wide with terror.
"Oh, my God! She wasn't lying!"
he groaned, sick with pain and fear alike.
"It's you!"
V paused then, struck by the significance of the words, and looking round toward Evie.
"I..."
she began, getting to her feet and trying to think of some word of explanation, of anything, anything to express the guilt and shame she now felt, that somehow made her feel even sicker than her terror. The mask tilted, oh so slightly, and by now she'd come to understand the expressions that supposedly inexpressive mask conveyed. Disappointment, understanding, and worst of all, perhaps, forgiveness.
"I'm sorry," she almost sobbed. "I had to..."
And then the words wouldn't come any more. All the ways he reminded her of her father came back to haunt her, counterbalanced against the awful betraying fear. Betraying him, betraying herself. She couldn't speak to him. She couldn't face him. She ran. "Evie," he said, looking after her as she fled. But by then she'd bolted from the room and nothing would call her back. Lilliman saw his chance then. The pain in his groin was still insufferable, but the pain of death would be far, far worse, and he found the energy to hurl himself toward the nightstand he'd been crawling over to before, toward the big, gilt-hinged and gold-edged Bible that sat there, closed upon it. A prayer before dying was the last thing he had in mind, however. Still doubled up with pain, he managed to flip open the book's ornately inlaid cover and reach into its hollowed-out interior, grabbing the ivory-handled revolver that lay hidden within. The Word of God and the power of the gun, the two pillars of the bishop's meteoric rise to success, of his very faith, If one couldn't take care of this terrorist, the other certainly would. Straightening up at last, he managed to spin round, pulling the trigger even as he did so. Two shots rang out, cracking open the silence of the evening like hammer blows. But the shots came too late, for V had already leapt toward Lilliman tiger swift as soon as he'd realized the man was on the move. He was already within the arc of the bishop's gun hand before the trigger was squeezed, the inky cloak flapping round the pair of them, making it difficult for Lilliman to see anything at all, only to feel V's gloved hand suddenly reaching for his own, grabbing, squeezing, wrenching. And then there was another loud crack, not gunfire this time, but the dry snapping of bone as V's iron grip broke the priest's wrist, sending him screaming to his knees. A moment, then, as the masked man stood holding the revolver, looking at it contemplatively. "And thus I clothe my naked villainy," he quoted, "with odd old ends stolen forth of holy writ, and seem a saint when most I play the devil." He tossed the gun across the room, far out of reach. Lilliman, a wiry figure still hunched and kneeling, sobbing with pain and clutching his wrist, finally managed to raise his head, looking up at the dark, death-like figure looming above him.
"Who are you?"
he managed to gasp.
"You once said I was the devil incarnate," V reminded him. "Remember that, Bishop? You do remember Larkhill, don't you?"
Larkhill. The word almost stopped Lilliman's heart. But he'd hardly done anything there, he'd always told himself, except turn the blind eye that he'd been well paid to turn, and to avail himself for free of the same sort of pleasures he paid for now. It was the others who'd done the experiments, not him, even if he had amused himself at the expense of the victims sometimes. And that was all behind him a long time ago, a shadow in the past, eradicated like the camp itself the night it burned to the ground, long gone, like the man who'd burned it. Like the man who'd burned it.
"Oh, dear God! Have mercy,"
he gasped, realization dawning, a realization more sickening than the pain.
"Not tonight, Bishop," V pronounced, the words a sentence too final to appeal. "Not tonight."
Outside in the rapidly darkening night, where the rain had thankfully stopped some time before, Evie Hammond was fleeing along the still wet street.